Case numbers 19-6390, 6392, 6393, 6394, United States of America versus Elance Lucas, Marcus Darden, A. Carlos Pennington, Derek Kilgore, respectively. Oral argument not to exceed 10 minutes for each of the defendants, 40 minutes for the plaintiff. Rob Eggert for the appellant. You may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel, your honors. Ladies and gentlemen, Elance Lucas was charged in just only two counts of this 45-count indictment. Both were conspiracies, conspiracy to violate RICO and conspiracy for drug trafficking. And we believe that he was denied individualized verdicts, that he was sentenced incorrectly, and the conviction should be reversed, and that the sentencing and his sentence must be reversed. And I'll start with the calculation of the drug weight applicable to Lucas in count one, the RICO count. We believe there was clear error here. The court did not conduct a relevant conduct test, did not do a scope of agreement test, did not individualize that weight as to Lucas as to count one. We believe that the applicable guideline states that when there is more than one underlying offense, that each underlying offense is treated as if contained in a separate count of conviction. That's exactly the case here. The drug trafficking was contained in a separate count of conviction. That's how it should have been treated.
Oh, in terms of what the judge should have done, is it correct that from your point of view, what the judge should have done was to say, okay, we've got the jury verdict on count one, but I need to rule by a preponderance of the evidence what was the scope of his agreement.
That is correct. That
what he should have done. Okay, now, let's assume for these purposes that you're right, that's what he should have done. We reverse. Where does that go when it goes back? Does the judge say, okay, Sixth Circuit has told me what I should do, and now I'll do it, which might be favorable to your client or might not be favorable to your client. Is that your position?
No, Judge. We believe, in fact, that if it did go back, the amount of weight would be as determined in count two, the 97 grams, 97.121 grams. The court conducted a relevant conduct test as to that. The jury, and was consistent.
That's relevant conduct as to, as you said, that conspiracy. I thought your legal position was that in sentencing on count one, you needed to determine the scope of the agreement, which could be considerably larger than the amount that you individually handled. So why wouldn't the judge then be able to do what I thought we just agreed he should have done in the first place?
Well, one, Judge, if it is sent back, we believe we'll come out very favorably from the 240 months.
It's certainly possible, but
20 months. And second, regarding if scope of agreement as to him, I understand what the court's saying, but the court did find 97 grams and found only, the jury found just more than 28 grams. So we think we would be treated favorably if the case went back. We believe that, and we would argue, obviously, 97 grams. I understand what the court's saying. Maybe I wouldn't succeed, but I'd argue that, and I think Lucas would benefit.
Okay, that's fine.
And just to illustrate the difference, when he was sentenced, each of the verdicts there in count one as to weight was identical, five keys or more, and the other one was 280 grams of crack or more. He ended up at a level 32. If we're correct, he would end up at a level 26, and the difference would be, you know, so much, 110 to 137, as opposed to the 240 months he got. In addition, we take exception with the 2 points he received for a gun. That bumped him up to 32, and even if it's or 26, depending on how you want to look at it, it was bumped up. Lucas, there was an auto accident, and when Lucas was 18, there were guns in the car, and then there was a gun in the car when it was under actually co-defendant Darden, and there were no drugs. There were no drugs in either incident. So we don't think there was any connection there between drugs and guns, and that he shouldn't have got that 2 points either. And we just don't, there was no drugs found. So we believe that the case was wrong as to sentencing. Regarding the RICO count, we submit there was insufficient evidence to sustain the conspiracy count as to RICO. Now, I know there was they found guilty of drug trafficking. In fact, at sentencing, they found only one drug, crack cocaine. But the other predicate was murder. And in his statement of reasons, the trial court removed that as a predicate.
I thought there were two aspects of drug trafficking that were related to the RICO count.
There were, but when they did the individual, they didn't find any powder. They just did crack. That's all.
That could be a different conspiracy, as Judge Boggs was indicating. There are the two, the RICO conspiracy and the drug conspiracy.
That is, but in the drug conspiracy, one of the main things they had was undercover buys to an undercover officer in Guthrie, Kentucky. And I think there was three of those buys. And while there were problems with the buys, putting that aside, there was really no connection between those buys and the conspiracy at all. I mean, he was selling not to another GD or anything like that. It was a setup by the government. He sold to a government agent. And so we don't see how those buys connected to the conspiracy at all. And when you look, Your Honor, at the rest of the evidence against him, there was Mr. Dowlin, I guess, said that he was a supplier, but it was contradicted by nearly every other government witness. It was contradicted by police. It was contradicted by other defendants who had pled. The Plush nightclub shooting, the judge has ruled, I know there was subject of another opinion, but he did not believe Mr. Dowlin and wouldn't even give my client the 2-point enhancement for that. And now, as we understand it, the trial court has found more problems with Mr. Dowlin. We mentioned this Brady violation about whether the gun was a 40 or 45. And Dowlin was basically the entire case against E. Lance Lucas. And even if one were to believe Dowlin, which the trial court is not believing him, having eyeballed him and having reviewed everything and is now again dealing with a Brady violation as to Dowlin, the trial court said that, a real problem with his truthfulness. But even if one believed Dowlin, guns are supposedly taken by Lucas to the nightclub, to the house, because for revenge, supposedly. But the incident never happens. Dowlin even says he doesn't even know if those guns were supposed to be used. It's basically he's at a meeting where something is discussed that never happened.
Your red light has been on. If you want to use
your
rebuttal time,
I'm sorry.
Or you may conclude.
We believe there is insufficient evidence. We thank you, and I think I saved time for rebuttal.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. Is Mr. Hawkins next?
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Travis Hawkins. I'm here on behalf of Marcus Darden. Our chief complaint with this trial is that it was not fair, and then it began with the poisoning of the well when the government proffered a police officer as a witness who was essentially became qualified as a gang expert, sort of under the radar, and then was allowed to testify about everything gangster disciples.
This is Sergeant Beeb?
This is Sergeant Gregory Beeb, Your Honor. This court has, in fact, in a recent case, United States v. Rios, authored by Judge Moore, has cautioned the government against the use of these kind of police officer cum gang experts and the problems that arise. This particular witness was particularly bad and particularly poisoned the well for this entire trial and the next 6 weeks of trial by getting on the stand and giving almost 200 pages of testimony, a day's worth of testimony about not only this gang, but the gang nationally, and making connections between this gang and the national gang, making factual connections between murders, essentially becoming the glue. This court called it the chronicler of the recent past. This officer came in. Yes, ma'am.
So the question is, Beebe is both a fact witness, and then you're saying is an expert witness but wasn't qualified as an expert witness, right?
That is the complaint, Your Honor.
And you kept objecting at trial to this?
I did, Your Honor. I objected 10 times during his testimony.
So where does it change? Where does it veer from being a fact witness to being an improper expert witness? And why is that improper expert witness testimony so damaging?
So a lot of the testimony that Sergeant Beebe gave was about murders. He talked about murders happening among these gang members and made connections between, made factual connections that witnesses had not yet made. He also talked about the structure, the hierarchy of the gang, the national organization. He talked about Larry Hoover, who is the putative founder of the gang, which originated in Chicago. And he drew this line between the national organization and this local group of young men from Guthrie, Kentucky, that we objected to. And he drew it based on, the government sought to shore that up by doing the very thing you'd do to get an expert qualified, which was to ask him questions about his experience, his training, his education. He cited a gang course that he had taken, studies he'd done on gangs. And when he was asked about Larry Hoover and what was the basis, his foundation for that knowledge, he said that he had studied it, he had learned about it somewhere.
But counsel, if all of these qualifications were brought out at trial, what magic is there in, quote, qualifying a witness? In other words, we have case law that says that if an expert's qualifications are just apparent, then there's no need to go through the formal step of qualifying a witness. So why doesn't that apply in your case?
Well, for one thing, we got no discovery on this particular issue. We weren't allowed to, I mean, that's under Rule 16. We should have, as defendants, been able to assess his testimony and be able to offer our own expert if they were going to bring this kind of proof in. That's one of the problems, is that there was a lack of a pretrial disclosure. So in order to address or remedy that problem, the government simply called him a lay witness. But in truth, he was an expert. I will concede he was offering testimony about things he knew, and he was also offering testimony about things that he had learned in his gang courses.
So assume we agree with you that there was improper testimony here, was it harmless error to allow that testimony?
I knew the court was going to ask this, and I believe that no, it was not harmless, because this jury had just sat down, and this was the very first person from whom they heard. And I made a point in my brief to talk about the primacy effect and how important it is, these first witnesses that a jury hears. And the jury got to sit for an entire day and listen to a police officer hold forth on the gangster disciples and their structure. And then, because he had this imprimatur of expertise, he was allowed to also draw the line for guilt. And essentially, it became a shortcut for proving guilt. It was a shortcut for the government. They didn't, he spoke of a double homicide, that the proof was, and this was a horrendous double murder committed by one of the co-defendants who had been severed because the government originally was seeking death. But the details of that murder were terrible. A young man and young lady just killed in cold blood. And he drew the line there and said, this is part. He took individual deeds, terrible deeds, and drew the line for the jury. This was part of this case. He talked about murders and motivations. He became the chronicler that this court has warned about. I see that my time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Tableman?
Good morning, if it pleases the court. My name is Kenneth Tableman. I'm here on behalf of Mr. DeCarlos Tittington. I'd like to thank the court for giving us the opportunity to come here and discuss this case with you. The heart of Mr. Tittington's appeal is really an attack on the sufficiency of the evidence against him on several of the counts. And sufficiency claims, of course, are very fact intensive, and I wanted to highlight for the court some factual matters that only really became apparent to me in preparing for argument this morning. On counts 40 and 42 against my client, excuse me, those counts related to the discovery of drugs in a car after a crash on February 15th, and a gun was found in the vehicle and 7.66 grams of cocaine powder in a baggie on top of some roses. This was the early morning hours after Valentine's Day. To establish the claim that this somehow related to possession of drugs with intent to distribute and then the derivative possession of a gun in furtherance of the drug trafficking crime, the government referred to some text messages found on a cell phone that was taken from Mr. Tittington at the scene of the crash. I have several points to make about that evidence. First of all, these are stale messages predating this incident by months. So the claim is the man possesses drugs with the intent to distribute them, and the proof is some messages on a phone that are months old.
Well, what about the quantity, the 7.66 grams? How much is an individual use quantity? This is regular cocaine.
I think it's somewhat disputed. There's no testimony about that I could find in this record. So now we're left to speculate. So I think we don't know. I think we can look at other cases. Other cases say 0.2 grams, but
0.2 grams, and this is 7.66?
Correct. So
that's 38 times as much.
Sure. The man has a loaf of bread in his car, as opposed to a slice.
There are 38 loaves of bread.
Well, but I think there's no proof. There's no testimony that says this is a distribution quantity, which if you look at the cases about quantity, there's always someone that says, usually an officer, in my experience, this is the amount that's used. There's no proof in this case. So we're left to speculate. And I think
The one where the government also says, well, you know, the GD is not supposed to use cocaine, so it must be for distribution. Isn't that one of their points?
That is one of their points. What I wanted to say about the phone messages is that the government says, and I missed this until a couple days ago, is that my client is portrayed as sending a message that indicates he's dealing drugs. If you look at the record, that's not true. At R1645, page 1550, 1554, 1555, you will see that the cell phone expert says the message was received. The message was, I've got a half or something of that nature. It's a drug trafficking message, but someone is sending that to my client, not my client sending it out. And the other messages that are referred to on his cell phone, which are also stale messages from December 22nd and December 24th, are pretty innocuous. What up, folk? Hi, hit me up, think about it. Those are the other two. The most damning one is the one that was received by my client. Well, I don't think the fact that you get a message from someone offering to sell you drugs means that you are possessing drugs with intent to distribute.
And all these messages were how much in advance of the car crash where he...
The car crash is February 15th. These messages are December 22nd and December 24th of the preceding year. So they're seven weeks prior. I respectfully suggest that this is just not enough evidence to prove that there's a possession with intent to distribute on this occasion.
So are there cases that you can tell us about, either in your favor or against, about if the evidence, assume the evidence is simply the possession of 7.66 grams of cocaine?
Well, in my brief, I cited the Supreme Court case, Turner case, which is, I think, 14 grams of powder, nothing else, and that was held to be insufficient. I cited another case where it was an ounce. That was held to be insufficient, and I can, they're in my argument in the brief, but they're in there. And there's other cases, 10 grams and more, that have been held to be insufficient. So I have three cases in the brief that stand for the proposition that that type of quantity without more is not enough.
So the question then is what more is there? And I'm putting to the side the text messages. So the more is there's the presence of the drug. Sorry, that's the beginning. There's the presence of the gun, and there's money, right? That's what else was found in the car.
But the other cases typically have much more.
And the money was $700 plus.
$743, which... that is a large amount of money. On the other hand, it's a continuum, right? It's more than 742 and it's less than 7,000. But I mean, I don't think that's an abhorrently large amount of money for someone to have. Other cases typically have things like drug scales, drug paraphernalia, presence in a drug house, things that are suggestive of drug trafficking. Here we have a man unconscious in a car that's crashed into a tree with a cell phone, and the court will recognize that cell phones are tools of the drug trade, and there's no current message on that phone that says, hey, come get drugs, hey, sell me drugs, nothing like that. In fact, it's all stale, and the proofs in this case in general were that Mr. Tiddington, if anything, was a very low-level guy that occasionally sold small quantities to people. But, I mean, that none of that is connected to this February 15th incident. Remember, he's on trial on these counts as to that date, what's going on that date. I see my time is up. I'll come back on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Gary Krim. I'm here on behalf of Derek Lamar Kilgore. I'm raised the issue again of sufficiency of the evidence. The focus of Mr. Kilgore's position, though, is the connection between acts of violence and the enterprise, and the nature of the drug conspiracy that he's charged with. And that's the basis for the attack on the verdicts. I'm not contending that Mr. Kilgore did not sell drugs. There are obviously testimony that he did sell drugs. And one of the co-conspirators talked about how good the marijuana was that he would purchase from Mr. Kilgore. There were lots of sales, but whether or not there was a conspiracy is the issue in these cases. And I'm also not contesting that there were tremendous acts of violence involved around Clarksburg, Tennessee, and that in the one instance, my client drove a car that was involved in a drive-by shooting. But the failure there of that case is the connection of that to drug conspiracy. There's no testimony that links the drive-by shooting to any particular act of involved in the drug conspiracy. The government, and the distinction is one that came about, I've located a case very recently, the Ledbetter case, which is cited in our additional authority, and that talks about the distinction between acts, crimes that are connected to the enterprise and items that are not connected to the enterprise. And here, what Mr. Kilgore was doing was not, he wasn't putting the money toward, he wasn't contributing the money. There was no, this is the first drug case I've ever seen where there's no discussion about fronting of drugs or, you know, any kind of a hierarchical structure. He was off on his own selling marijuana and other drugs.
Am I confusing things or wrong? I thought there was some box that everybody had to put dues in to be part of this.
The GDs collected dues from people in the conspiracy and people not in the conspiracy. This was a relatively small amount of money. It was not the kind of money that would finance any kind of serious drug transactions. People would use it for...
Couldn't that indicate be evidence of his participating in an enterprise? Was that argued by the government, for instance?
I think it probably was. The enterprise there, though, was not involved in the drug conspiracy. There's no linking of that to the drug conspiracy.
You're just challenging the RICO conspiracy, then?
Yes. No, I'm challenging both. I'm challenging the RICO conspiracy because they did not connect the acts of violence involved in the drive-by shooting and other acts of violence to any kind of drug enterprise. Basically, none of the money flowed to the other participants in the conspiracy.
And so was your point there that some people paid dues even though they weren't members of the group or members of the conspiracy?
There were members of the GD that were not members of the conspiracy.
And how do we know that?
Well, they published membership lists. I don't have the exhibit number, but they had membership lists, and most of those people many of those people never appeared in any of the discussion about drugs or about controlled buys or anything like that.
But that doesn't mean that they wouldn't have been members of the conspiracy either if they caught them or if they were worth prosecuting. I mean, there's not a negative inference from the fact that they didn't charge and try every person on the membership list, is there?
Well, but there's no testimony about those people being involved in the drugs.
Right, but there's testimony about your client.
Oh, yeah.
You think it's insufficient,
well,
there's
testimony about my client making sales. There isn't testimony. My client was not connected to the cooking of cocaine that was done very early on in the process. But I think there were people involved in the GD that I don't think you can infer that they were part of the drug conspiracy.
But were those people also selling drugs? In other words,
there's no evidence of them selling drugs.
Right, but here we have a drug selling conspiracy, and we know that proceeds from those sales were contributed to the common fisc. And by putting it in this box, right? So all you had to do was pay dues. You got to keep your drug money as long as you paid your dues. And there's no evidence that your client has any legitimate employment. So why isn't that enough for a rational jury to infer that he was part of the conspiracy?
Well, because the proceeds of the the box weren't used for the drug conspiracy. People would come and use it to pay rent. They would send some of them. There was some discussion about money being sent to prisoners, people in prison, but there's no the connecting that box to the selling of drugs isn't, they didn't do it.
And didn't your client receive, wasn't his supplier also a supplier of other people who were in this conspiracy?
I don't believe there's any testimony about my client getting drugs, about supplying where my client got his drugs.
I thought...
There's some discussion about, there was one person that was supposedly the main supplier very early on. There is testimony about a couple of other people becoming the main suppliers. But when you read the testimony, the next page down, it turns out that the person, Mr. Dowlin again, he testified, he was asked how many sales he'd made from over the course of almost a decade. And he said, I don't really remember. And he got pushed a little bit further, and he said, maybe five sales. Well, if this is the main source of drugs, then that person would be getting more than five sales. And the particular language was sales. It wasn't, this is not where drugs are being distributed and people are giving credit and then they come back in. This is the first drug conspiracy case, and I've been looking at these things since the early 90s, where nobody is fronting drugs. It's all cash.
Unless there are any other questions, your time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Cecil Van Deventer on behalf of the United States. I'd like to start, I think, where Mr. Krim left off about kind of the proof about drug trafficking, because this is a little bit of an unusual case insofar as it's not kind of your standard issue chain conspiracy with a top-level supplier, street-level dealers, and kind of intermediaries in between. But what the proof really showed was that drug trafficking was absolutely central to the Gangster Disciples operation. So part of the impetus for becoming a Gangster Disciple is that it offers the promise of money, power, and status. And it offers money in the form of facilitation of drug trafficking. And that took a number of different forms. Most prominently, there were certain geographic areas where GDs and only GDs could safely sell drugs. Other members who weren't necessarily actively selling at any given time provided kind of armed security or, at a minimum, provided a credible threat of violent reprisal if someone were to try and come into a GD's territory and rob someone who was selling drugs or compete with the GDs who were selling there. In addition, you had shared stash houses, shared trap houses, guns that were kind of owned collectively by the gang or by the deck that could be used for different purposes. You had testimony about... There wasn't a lot of fronting of drugs, but there was testimony about some. Daniel Dowlin testified that when he got out of prison, he was given a large, I think maybe a kilo or some large quantity of drugs just to help him get back on his feet. You could also, as a GD, tap into this network, both kind of within the gang and, I should say, within the deck and then within the national gang to find sources of supply, get advice on how to kind of cook and sell drugs. So members routinely made money by selling drugs, even if they did operate with some degree of autonomy when doing so. And then in addition, the proceeds from the drug trafficking was paid, as Your Honor noted, to the box. There was a lot of testimony about...
When you said the proceeds were paid to the box, I thought the box involved relatively small amounts of dues. And the proceeds the individual seller would keep.
That's right. So I guess the way I would put it, Your Honor, is members were required to pay monthly dues as well as occasionally fines and other monies to the box. And what the testimony showed was that none of the defendants had legitimate jobs. They all made money from drug trafficking. And so whatever money went to the box in the form of dues or otherwise inevitably came in whole or at least in large measure from drug trafficking. And then once that money went to the box, it helped fund a lot of the other operations of the gang. So it could be used, for example, if someone got arrested, it could be used to make bail or hire an attorney. If someone was in prison, it could be put on their commissary. If someone was fugitive from justice, it could be used to pay for their travel and expenses. And it could also be taken out to purchase more drugs if they thought that that would be a way to kind of increase the supply in the box. Could be used to purchase guns that again, could be used.
You could get a loan against the box?
That's right. Not necessarily everyone could do it, but a treasurer could authorize if there was, you know, if the treasurer, for example, saw, you know, there's an opportunity to make a quick buck by buying this and reselling it, I can borrow that money from the box. If I don't have it, buy it, sell it, put it back in the box with interest.
Your opponent was describing it more as a social welfare fund, that if people were short on their rent, they could borrow from the box. Was there evidence to that effect?
That was one of the many uses that money from the box could be used for, yes.
Was there any testimony about the proportions of the social welfare aspect versus the facilitating of the drug aspect?
I don't know that any witness tried to sort of parcel it out in percentages, but you know, there was documentation about it going to people to make bail, put it on their commissary, and testimony about it being used for the other purposes, buying guns and so forth. So certainly used for all of them, but I don't think we could parcel out exactly what percentage for each. So turning to Mr. Tiddington's sufficiency challenges to the two convictions stemming from the February 2015 incident, the quantity itself, 7.66 grams, you know, it was a quantity that I think it's fair to say was not so overwhelmingly large that it couldn't possibly be consistent with personal use, but it was large enough that it was fair for a jury to infer that it was used for distribution.
Was there any testimony about this amount being larger than would be expected for personal use, or any testimony at all about that question? Because I would think as a juror would want to know, is this something that some person normally would have in their possession for their self-use?
So I know that Detective Will Evans testified about prices for different quantities, and so what the jury would have heard was that this amount, 7.66 grams, would have been worth roughly $350 at the time. And so I think a juror could infer from that that's not, and you know, by contrast, they heard that, say, half of a gram would be $20 or something like that. So I don't know that anyone said, here's how much a person would use on a single night, for example, but they had some frame of reference for how much this was worth versus how much kind of a person buying for himself or herself would purchase.
Your colleague cited in passing a Supreme Court case, which he said says 14 grams wasn't enough. Is that a fair representation of that case, or do you have a response?
Your Honor, I don't recall that case well enough to be able to distinguish it on the fly, but I will say that the important thing that I think was kind of omitted from the description of the facts was that this was not sort of a two-count case where it was just the incident of the crashed vehicle plus the text messages, and I'll come back to the text messages in a moment. But there was, you know, mountains of evidence about how the Gangster Disciples generally and Mr. Tiddington specifically sold drugs regularly. So, for example, Lawrence Mitchell, who's a Gangster Disciple, he testified that he bought drugs from Mr. Tiddington over 50 times. Daniel Dowland testified that he bought drugs from Mr. Tiddington on at least 20 occasions. DeZork Ford, who was a member of a different gang, talked about buying crack from Mr. Tiddington in Lincoln Homes. Crystal Allen testified that she saw Mr. Tiddington selling crack in Lincoln Homes. So
did any of those people testify as to how much they bought?
Yes, it was usually kind of amounts of, you know, couple grams here and there. Nobody testified that, you know, they bought a whole kilogram at a time for Mr. Tiddington, lots of testimony about how he had, I think someone used the phrase, a steady stream of customers buying drugs from him.
Buying drugs in small gram quantities, in other words, a gram, 2 grams.
Yes, Your Honor.
Nobody would have bought 7.66? In other words, right? You know what I'm getting at.
Exactly. All of the people generally who bought from, who testified about buying from him, testified about buying for themselves to resell, and they were buying smaller quantities than this.
I
think that would support the jurors' fair inference that this was a distribution quantity. And then with regard to the text messages, so some are from December, some are actually from January. I think the last one in Government Exhibit 3821 is from January 15th, so about a month before. But in addition to the sort of more innocuous ones that my friend highlighted, you know, one of the text messages says, "Save me half of that, no cut."
That's from someone else to him, a text from someone else to him?
Yes.
And that was the one that was 2 months?
No, this was one that was January 11th. The one between Mr. Tennington and Mr. Darden was, you know, about a half as well. Mr. Dowland testified that they would not have been talking about, for example, a half gram. That would have been at least a half ounce or perhaps even a half kilogram.
But I still don't understand how one can say that messages that were a month or so earlier show intent to distribute on a date a month or so later.
Well, I think, you know, so had this been a two-count indictment, and some of that evidence probably would have been 404B material. Here it was all admissible as part of the larger conspiracies, and so its admissibility wasn't challenged. But even if it had been 404B evidence, that's admissible to show motive and intent, particularly when in a drug case the defendant says, "I had no intent to distribute." And so if there's, you know, if the jury hears a pattern over the course of years stretching up to, you know, a month before of this person kind of routinely having drugs, corresponding with drug purchasing customers, that's something that the jury can consider when deciding whether he had the requisite intent to distribute. And then again, you know, we had the $743 in cash, we had the gun, and so a number of factors that at least would allow any rational juror to infer that he intended to distribute. And of course, as Judge Boggs referenced, one of the laws of the Gangster Disciples was their members are not allowed to ingest addictive drugs like cocaine, and there was no testimony that Mr. Tennington violated that rule or was otherwise a cocaine user himself. Turning to the evidentiary issues that Mr. Darden raised, so Detective Beebe, I think his testimony was very different from the testimony that was identified as potentially problematic in Rios and the Second Circuit case of Mejia that Rios alludes to. So as an initial matter, of course, there's not the kind of dual testimony problem where a witness is formally qualified and cloaked with the kind of court's imprimatur of expertise, and then his fact testimony is given what the court calls, you know, unwarranted or unmerited credibility. But more importantly, this was not a case like Rios and Mejia where the witness gets on the stand and kind of testifies about the core charged facts. I think Mr. Hawkins talked about Mr. Detective Beebe drawing a line, but really, he didn't try and say, for example, you know, through the course of my investigation, I determined that Brandon Hardison murdered these two people on Main Street. What he said was, this is a photo of the house where the murder was committed. Then other witnesses who were there, who heard confessions or otherwise, they said, Mr. Hardison did it. It wasn't Detective Beebe who tried to kind of draw that line for the jury. Likewise, you know, he didn't say, I've determined that that Maurice Burks killed Malcolm Wright. He said, here's a photo of C-Ray's. You know, here are the key kind of individuals who are members of the gang, but didn't try and testify in a summary fashion that he had determined that these defendants were guilty of the charged crime.
What about Sheridan and Wyand, the double murder?
Mm-hmm. Right, so that's the Main Street murder I was alluding to before, where he introduced kind of a photo of Main Street, where the murder happened, may have introduced some photos of the crime scene, but didn't try and say, I have determined who committed it, and it was this member of the Gangster Disciples.
From your view, he was saying, here's something that you'll hear about later on.
Exactly.
And then there were people who testified about when and how that murder occurred. Is that right?
Exactly, Your Honor. So a lot of his testimony was focused on just introducing photographs of individuals and locations that other witnesses with firsthand knowledge would kind of flesh out information about.
Well, was he testifying, among other things, that so-and-so was a member of the gang and so-and-so was a member of the gang and this is what the gang does in general? So why isn't that based on expert knowledge, expert testimony, as opposed to his being a lay fact witness?
Yes, Your Honor. So this is not a case, for example, where, you know, a case gets charged, an expert who has studied up on the national gang gets brought in, he reviews a bunch of reports and discovery and testifies based on his conclusions based on reviewing that. Detective Beebe had been investigating the Clarksville deck of the Gangster Disciples personally for years and years. You know, he had conducted surveillance on all of these defendants personally, probably arrested many, if not all of them, himself. He had reviewed dues rosters for the Clarksville deck that listed individual, you know, here are the members, here are their phone numbers. And so this wasn't sort of, you know, I went to a training course and learned X. He says, I have looked at photos where people are flashing gang signs. I have looked at a list where the members are listed. And so based on that personal knowledge, these are the members of the Gangster Disciples, which, again, wasn't really in dispute in this case. I mean, that many of them and many of the defendants in opening kind of acknowledged their membership in this gang. Certainly by the time of closing, they did and had other defenses to the charges. And then, of course, even if any portion of Detective Beebe's testimony had been improperly admitted, it would be harmless because, for example, as to kind of membership in the gang, history of the gang, we had numerous gang members who got up and said, you know, I was a member of this deck. Each of those defendants was a fellow gang member with me. Here are our rules. Here's, you know, the 17 laws, the we pledge, the I pledge, and so forth. Turning now, I think, to the sentencing issues. So it's certainly true as that if you look at the sentencing transcript for Mr. Lucas, that one of the things that was front and center in Judge Crenshaw's mind as he calculated the offense level was, A, that each count needs to be calculated individually, and B, that there can be a difference between criminal liability and sentencing accountability. He referenced that principle several times. And he ultimately elected to rely on the jury's finding as to weight with regard to count one. So again, calculated count one and count two separately, as my friend says he was required to do. And when the jury found that it was reasonably foreseeable to Mr. Lucas that the conspiracy as a whole, the RICO conspiracy, that is, involved the distribution of 5 kilos or more of powder, 280 grams or more of crack, the court could reasonably rely on that. And frankly, I think that probably was an extremely conservative estimate of Mr. Lucas's quantity that was attributable to him under 1B1.3. So, for example, application note 4C6 to 1B1.3 discusses this distinction between kind of independent drug dealers in the same area and drug dealers who pool resources and profits. And in the former case, where it's just people who are aware of each other but not really operating together, each individual drug dealer wouldn't be responsible for the quantities of the others in the area. But in the latter case, where people are pooling resources, then they are responsible for each of the others. Here, Mr. Lucas was an active member of the Gangster Disciples going back to 2007 at least. And so the period of time when Rex Whitlock and Trey Galbraith were getting, you know, 7-8 kilos at a time from Atlanta, that was all done when Mr. Lucas was a part of the gang, was an active member of the conspiracy. So that could, I think, have fairly been attributed to him. So this final...
Well, but you make the point that these things could be fairly attributed to him, but the judge didn't independently attribute that. He said the jury found on a question about reasonable foreseeability of the whole RICO conspiracy. So how can you say that the judge actually did what he should have done? You've given good reasons that he could have, and we had a colloquy about what happens if we were to remand, but can you help us any in tying that down, or can you say anything about the scope of any remand, if there should be?
I think the way I'd put it, Your Honor, is to the extent that the defendant claims that he suffered prejudicial error in the calculation of the base offense level, it's clear that the district court had ample evidence in the record to find at least the quantity that he found, which was the quantity dictated by the jury's verdict, and fully supported by facts in the record. I think the facts could have also supported a much higher finding. We haven't specifically challenged that on a cross appeal, but if the court is determining, is there a need to vacate the sentence or remand for a resentencing hearing based on this kind of overstatement of his base offense level, I think the answer is clearly no, because of the jury's finding and the evidence.
Well, you haven't given me a good reason, I don't think, in what you said so far, to say that the judge actually did what he was supposed to. I thought almost at the beginning you said, well, yes, they're right that he's supposed to look at the scope of the individual agreement. And if he's supposed to do that, he didn't, except to say it's the same as what the jury found on a different question.
Well,
Or are you saying they really are the same question?
Exactly, Your Honor. I think if you look at kind of what the jury was asked to find, it included a question about kind of reasonable foreseeability. And given the nature of this enterprise, there really wasn't kind of a scope question, a line.
Now, you're saying that the scope of his agreement in this, I mean, as a generality, the scope of your agreement for sentencing purposes is not the same as the reasonable foreseeability, right?
Correct. Those are true.
Okay. Yes, I mean.
So I think the jury's verdict clearly at least contemplated the reasonable foreseeability prong, and I think the nature of the evidence at trial showed that all of this drug trafficking was within the scope of his agreement. You know, this wasn't a case where kind of he joined at the very end. It was.
And so your argument is that because the evidence showed that, the judge didn't need to say that he found it. And there is a difference between could have found and ontologically had to have found, therefore we don't need to worry about it.
Well, I think that's right. So certainly a sentencing hearing after a lengthy trial is going to look different than a sentencing hearing where all the proof comes in at the hearing itself. In an ideal world, would the judge have, you know, stated explicitly on the record, I agree with and find as an independent matter that the quantities found by the jury with respect to count one were within the scope and reasonably foreseeable, but there was...
Well, it's not or, it's...
Oh, I'm sorry, and.
It's within the... Right, exactly.
I apologize if I said okay. Within the scope and reasonably foreseeable, but I think given that the sufficiency of his explanation wasn't challenged, there was, you know, it was all about what quantity the court should use. Court found this quantity that was found by the jury, and I think that was, as a factual finding, certainly not clear error given all the other evidence supporting it.
So you're not relying on his statement that I would have found the 240 months anyway?
Well, I think that is another factor for the court to consider. I know, you know, in certain cases the court has expressed some skepticism if it perceives that statement to be sort of rote or boilerplate.
Wasn't it boilerplate in all of these cases?
I'm sorry?
Wasn't it stated in all of these cases in a boilerplate fashion?
Well, it was stated in all of these cases. I guess I would dispute that it was in a boilerplate fashion.
Did the district judge rely on particulars of each individual defendant in saying that he would sentence to the same amount if he were wrong on anything?
I think what's clear from the sentencing hearings is that the court took the 3553A factors very seriously and didn't kind of just sentence within the guidelines as a matter of course and then try and protect himself by saying, oh, well, I would have imposed the same sentence either way. I think, you know, in Mr. Luke's sentencing hearing, for example, he talks extensively about his childhood, his background, the factors that may have pushed him towards crime, but how his sister had the same background and went another direction, talked about his role in the offense, how he was mostly a consistent drug dealer, wasn't as involved in kind of the violent aspects of the gang's operations. And so this is not, you know, calculate the guideline range, impose a sentence somewhere in the middle, and then make a boilerplate sentence to try and cover himself with regard to the calculations. I think he really thought that after seeing, you know, months of proof at trial, Mr. Lucas should be sentenced to 20 years. And I don't think there's any reason to think that was just kind of a meaningless boilerplate statement, Your Honor. Mr. Lucas raises some other challenges to the sufficiency of his convictions, but we're happy to stand on the brief on those issues and any others unless the court has additional questions.
Any further questions?
Yep. Thank you, Your Honor. We just ask that the court affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
So I think each defendant has rebuttal time. We'll start with Mr. Eggert.
Thank you, Your Honors. The court, the trial court, when it calculated the when it calculated the drug weight as to Lucas, believed, and I believe, Your Honor, it cited your case, Judge Boggs, United States versus Crockett, and he seemed to think that that case, it's on page 101 of the November 26, 2019 transcript, and he seemed to believe there he had no choice but to follow that weight, that he couldn't do anything but go with that weight. So he didn't say, I'm going to rely on the jury finding because I think it's right. He didn't say, I'm conducting my own test and I would agree with that determination. He thought he was absolutely bound, and that's why he didn't do any relevant conduct. He didn't do anything there. And recall that that verdict was the same as to each defendant.
Do you have the page ID number of what you just cited?
21546.
Thank you. Yep, I can find it.
Yeah, it's a couple hundred pages on. And it would not have directly contradicted a jury's finding to go with a lower amount. And somehow he felt he wasn't able to conduct that inquiry. But quite clearly, he was able to, should have done it, didn't do it, and it wasn't because he decided independently that that figure was right. In fact, he pretty much cut it off. He says, maybe you want to look at this at lunchtime, United States versus Crockett. And a court can't rely on findings that directly contact with the jury verdict, end quote. And that was pretty much the end of that inquiry there as to the count one. So we believe respectfully that the government is wrong on that, and the case does have to come back. Finally, regarding the conspiracy and Lucas's role in the conspiracy, you heard about these terrible deeds, and there were awful crimes committed, and one of the issues we did raise, and we think it's illustrated by this argument, was severance. And I know you'd have to review it on plain error. There was no motion for it. But literally, there were days and days and days where nothing pertaining to E. Lance Lucas was given at trial. And yet there was the horrible crime after horrible crime. There was no evidence he had any connection, knew about it, nothing. And so given the situation of the horrible crimes, and I think out of 80-some witnesses, only seven mentioned Lucas, and that except for Dowen, these drug buys were to a government informant, except for Dowen's testimony, we believe he should get a new trial on the RICO and that he definitely needs a new sentencing, and that's what we would request. Thank you.
Hawkins.
Thank you. The court, this going back to the experts, the multiple experts that were brought in by the government, and we would say paraded as lay experts. Beebe is probably the most problematic, although the court made the mistake multiple times and conflated Rule 701 with 702 by confusing the standard for what is lay testimony. I think Sergeant Beebe's testimony, since it's the very first witness that this jury heard, and the horrors that Sergeant Beebe recounted in this very first impression that was made on the jurors cannot be overlooked, and it needs to be taken in whole. It's about 200 pages long, and it's peppered with objections, but ultimately Sergeant Beebe, he did draw a line between these murders and horrendous deeds and the defendants that were sitting at the table.
Did he draw a line between your client and the horrendous deeds?
Well, I think he drew a line between, frankly, all the defendants that were sitting there. In fact, I think that if the court gives relief on this issue, specifically, I think probably all the defendants are entitled to the relief. Because ultimately what he did was he told a story. He helped the government. Instead of bringing in witness after witness and building the story, the government brought Sergeant Beebe in to do a shortcut and to bring it all together. The problem with that is, and Mr. Lucas's counsel raised the issue of severance. I believe there are probably some misjoined offenses in this case. For example, the double murder, which was so horrendous that we got to see autopsy photos of and that the jurors were aghast about. It really didn't involve anybody but this one individual, Mr. Hardison, who was not on trial with these defendants. But yet, Sergeant Beebe, when he got on the stand, he talked about that double murder. He talked about other murders and made a cohesive story for the jurors that otherwise the government would have had to do the hard work of proving. And he provided a shortcut. And his testimony in its totality was both factual layperson, but it was also expert in nature.
Thank you.
I see my time is up.
I respectfully suggest that the proofs here as to the 7.66 grams are just not sufficient to support the jury's verdict. And in my brief, I've cited cases that involve much greater quantities. And for example, we've got the Monger case, 185 F3rd 574, 10.66 grams of crack cocaine was not enough. This is powder cocaine. And I'm going to go back to my analogy of a loaf of bread. $350, something that costs $20 a dose, that's 17 doses. So I just submit to the court respectfully, I don't believe that suffices.
Your opponent mentioned that there was other testimony about other people frequently buying from Mr. Tiddington. Would that be allowed to be added to the facts of this particular finding of 7 grams in his car that was in the accident?
I think it's kind of I guess I'm going to equivocate on that. It's kind of a 404B problem, and I think it depends on the timing. I believe the testimony about sales predates this February 14th, 2015 incident by some years. And so I think there'd have to be some type of a balancing. A balancing, Your Honor.
Balancing.
Some type of balancing test.
But as a generality, if there's a lot of evidence of repeated sales by a person, and then the question is, the next time he has a bunch of drugs, is he likely to be selling them? You know, it's kind of like I go to a jewelry store and the guy sells me a ring all the time, and then later on he's got a ring. Is it likely at the same store that he's going to sell it rather than give it to his fiance? I mean, it's an inference. And it's no question that it's an inference, but is it a reasonable inference that some juror could draw?
Well, I'm going to fall back to the concept that he's on trial for what happened on February 15th, and he's not on trial for being a person that in the past has done something. And in those 404B cases, the government is required to show that they're trying to prove something other than propensity evidence, which is prohibited. So in those cases, the trial court makes a threshold determination. Did it happen in the past? That could have been disputed in this case. And is it more probative than prejudicial? None of which, of course, happened in this scenario. And I think it's... I guess the court is to decide how far are we going to go in letting someone's past behavior control a current charge. So for the reasons set forth in my brief, we respectfully request the court vacate.
But there was no specific objection to the prior testimony about the purchases from
I'm not aware that there was, yeah. Thank you very much, Charles.
The government used the language, this is not your usual drug conspiracy. I would submit that this is so unusual that it's not a drug conspiracy. The example, the language is constantly that of selling and buying, not of fronting, not of cooperative purchases. The kilogram that he talks about that Mr. Dallin was given, the word was given. It wasn't that he was fronted a kilo, and there's no testimony that he was expected to repay or that he even repaid the proceeds of that kilogram of cocaine.
I'm sorry, that was with respect to Dowling?
Dowling. Dowling is...
He's one of the witnesses, right? But that's connected to your client?
When we were talking about the contents of the box and conspiracy generally, that was what the government was...
Right, okay, but your client wasn't involved with that kilo.
No, my client was not involved directly in that.
Okay, that's what confused me.
No,
fine, go ahead.
I'm sorry to...
Go ahead.
I wouldn't want to cause that kind of confusion.
No.
It's almost as bad as leaving it on a
knife. I was trying to help you there, I thought.
Yeah. The box, Judge Moore, you describe it as a social welfare fund, and that's... Frankly, that's what it was funded at. This was not a box that had the sufficient proceeds to retain counsel or to provide bail.
Wasn't there testimony that that's what the box was used for?
There was a lot of testimony. There was testimony, I think it was probably Mr. Dowling, who was the government's most quoted witness. Mm-hmm. But there were there is no evidence that the proceeds of the box were ever used for bail or retained counsel. And the balances weren't enough to, I suppose if you were charged with a trespassing, it might have enough money in it to pay for it.
Was there evidence about the tally in the box?
I believe there were records shown about the balances. I don't have those exhibits in front of me. And I have not.
At least the government seemed to say, well, sometimes you could take money and invest for higher returns elsewhere, which implied it was a substantial amount. I just didn't know.
My understanding about the box was it did not have large amounts of money in it.
And is the box the only sort of collective property? In other words, it seems that there's protection being provided, there's stash houses, communal...
Well,
support.
Again, when you look at the statements about protection, for example, I cited in our reply brief, but Mr. Dowling talks about how all these benefits, and then he was asked, then the government's next question was, do you know of the instances where that happened? No, there were no. So there's a lot of theory in this conspiracy, but very little. But when it comes down to actual evidence, it's the citations to the record where things happened. It's not there. My time is up. I would request that our solution is in our briefs.
Thank you all.
I don't remember which counsel.
Thank you all for your argument. And I see that many of you defense lawyers, Mr. Hawkins, Mr. Tableman, and Mr. Krim, are all appointed pursuant to the Criminal Justice Act. And we thank you for your service to your clients in pursuit of justice here. So the case will be submitted, and the clerk may prepare and call the next case when ready.